Welcome to New World Notes and to the final part of Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land. I'm Kenneth Doust. We'll look at three more strategies the media use to distort the truth, and then ask, how do we get to peace in the Middle East? PR strategy number 5, myth of U.S. neutrality. Seth Ackerman of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
You'll see on most commentators in the media constantly urging the U.S. to become more engaged in the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Today that the U.S. must get more involved in settling the conflict.
There are growing calls for President Bush to take on a more active role.
Nearly everyone agrees the U.S. must play a more active role in an attempt to...
The premise of that view is the idea that's stated over and over again, that the U.S. is merely trying to bring about a peace, trying to bring the two sides together. It has no preconceptions about what, you know, whose side is right and whose side is wrong, you know, which side needs to make more compromises and which doesn't. And I think that's a fundamentally inaccurate view of how U.S. diplomacy has worked over the past several years.
Professor Karen Pfeiffer.
The United States has presented itself as a neutral broker between these two parties. But if you look at its actions rather than its words, you see that it has favored Israel almost 100% of the time. The U.S. has vetoed resolutions many times that would have put a stop to Israel's actions in the territory.
In New York, a push by the Palestinians and their supporters to win a UN Security Council resolution calling for an end to the violence was vetoed by the United States.
Israel has rejected UN involvement in the conflict, backed by its closest ally, the United States.
Professor Noam Chomsky.
The U.S. blocked diplomatic moves from the Arab states, from Europe, from the PLO, anything, because it just refused to accept this kind of diplomatic settlement. Well, there's a name for that in the United States. It's called the peace process. What it actually is the process by which the United States prevented peace.
The United States has struggled for decades with widely varying success and failure to help ease this Mideast conflict.
The United States is a neutral broker between Israel and the Palestinians is a cruel joke on both Palestinians and the Arab world at large. The United States has exercised its veto many, many times in the Security Council, but perhaps worse than that is that it provides billions of dollars of aid to Israel, a lot of it military aid, and a lot of it in the most lethal possible form.
American aid to Israel totals over $6 billion per year. Israel receives $3 billion in direct aid, two-thirds of which is military aid intended for the purchase of American-made weapons. In addition, Israel receives $3 billion in indirect aid, at least half of which is used for military ventures, such as subsidizing Israel's domestic armaments industry. Not included in this figure are other forms of military aid, such as weapons given to Israel free of charge, including fighter planes and attack helicopters. Total U.S. aid to Israel since 1949 has amounted to over $100 billion, making Israel, a country the size of New Jersey, the fourth most powerful military in the world, in possession of the largest fleet of F-16 fighter planes outside the United States.
The international community says that better not mean more of this, the devastation caused by Israel's F-16s. So Israel's tanks, missiles, and helicopter gunships are no longer enough. Now Ariel Sharon has used fighter planes. America supplied the planes, seen here in action in Lebanon.
The pipeline of violence is very much stamped made in USA. I mean, the United States has been brokering an alleged peace process for how long, and what does the situation look like? I mean, if peace were the obvious, were the genuine goal, it would be such a catastrophic failure that, you know, it would have ended a long time ago. Clearly, in the name of peace, other things are going on here.
Control over Middle East oil will provide us with veto power over Japan and other countries. They rely on Middle East oil. If we have our hand on the lever, we have veto power over what they do. These are techniques of world control and the source of enormous profits and wealth, not just for the energy corporations.
The United States, at least the Bush administration and its strategists, have recognized that the EU and possibly Russia are potential competitors. And so being able to keep control of trade, investment, and the oil industry in a region that is very close to Russia, very close to Europe, this is a way for the United States to maintain its hegemony.
There's a framework of state policy. It's been in place for about 30 years of supporting Israel as a kind of base for projection of U.S. power in the region.
That support intensified under Clinton and intensified even more in the Bush administration with the rise to power of the neoconservatives in the Defense Department, such as Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Donald Rumsfeld, and others like them.
Journalist Robert Fisk.
Now, when in effect you have people so close to Israel inside the U.S. administration, I think Israel is in the White House.
This was the sixth meeting between Mr. Bush and Prime Minister Sharon.
Every time he comes, I learn a lot.
The president has never...
There is no difference any longer between U.S. policy in the Middle East and Israeli policy.
Secretary of State Colin Powell addressing the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC.
All of us here tonight are brought together by a deep commitment to Israel's security, prosperity, and freedom, and to the strongest possible relationship between Israel and the United States.
The U.S. wants to make sure that Israel can control the situation by violence, as it does, of course, and it'll give them the diplomatic cover, and it'll give them the military means.
Congress, which is very, very strongly pro-Israeli at the moment, 94 votes to 2 was the way a resolution was passed in the Senate the other day, wholeheartedly endorsing everything Israel is doing.
At no point, however, has the mainstream media, whether television or newspapers, confronted and challenged this issue in your country, in the United States.
To find critical views on American diplomacy, you really have to go beyond the mainstream media. You can find very critical views in the British press. You can even find critical views in the Israeli press. Whereas there will be some criticisms at the margins of details of how America conducts its diplomacy in the Middle East, you don't find a real alternative viewpoint in the mainstream media.
It is the last taboo subject in America. You can talk about lesbians, blacks, gays, anything you want, but not America's relationship, or not any serious examination of America's relationship with Israel, or what Israel is doing, albeit almost always with American weapons.
U.S. journalists are enmeshed in symbiotic relationships with the powerful. Instead of being independent and critical, journalists typically are dependent on policymakers and unwilling to raise the crucial critical questions. Rather than monitoring the game of power, most journalists are simply part of that game.
You only have to see the press conferences, Condoleezza Rice, George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld. It's all on first name.
And with that, I'm happy to take your questions. Helen?
Yeah, April?
David?
Yes, Randy.
John?
What do you know about the sourcing of the British?
But the relationship between American journalists, particularly television journalists, and the centers of power has become incestuous. So close, because an argument could cut you off from access to the center of power, so close that it is impossible any longer to convey what you know about the centers of power. All you can do is say what you think they mean and what you know they say. So what's the point of journalism?
PR strategy number 6, myth of the generous author.
1991 marked the beginning of a series of peace efforts. Of the most recent and well-known were the negotiations that took place in the summer of 2000 at Camp David with then-President Bill Clinton, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, and former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. The aftermath of their breakdown is perhaps the clearest example of the Israeli PR machine at work.
Journalist Alyssa Solomon.
There are two pieces of this narrative that the Israeli propaganda machine has been very effective in convincing everybody of. The first is that what happened at Camp David was that Barak made the most generous offer that any Israeli ever had or would make. Arafat answered with violence.
The charismatic crusader for a Palestinian homeland has rejected what many thought was the best peace deal he could get, and he's failed to stop the terror.
In fact, 2 years ago, Ehud Barak did lay it all out on the table. A Palestinian homeland, giving back over 90% of Jewish settlements, even a plan which divided Jerusalem.
What was being offered to the Palestinians was an impossible deal that no Palestinian leader could possibly have accepted.
They proposed creating a Palestinian state in most of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. But this state was not going to have control over its borders. It was not going to have control over its airspace. It was not going to have control of the only resource, natural resource in that area, which were the major aquifers. And it was going to be bifurcated and crisscrossed by Israeli settlements and Israeli roads. So it was going to be broken up into at least four or five different pieces. It was a nominal Palestinian state within effectively a greater Israel.
It's as if the Palestinians have been put in the basement of their house, and they, you know, might be allowed most of the rooms, but Israel gets to control all of the hallways and some of the rooms. So you want to go from your living room to your bedroom, you got to go through an Israeli checkpoint. You want to go, you know, from your kitchen to your bathroom, you got to go through an Israeli checkpoint. Well, do you really control your house under that set of circumstances? It did not offer Palestinians unimpeded access to their holy sites, and it did not offer Palestinians any solution to the 3 million Palestinian refugees who live in these refugee camps under horrendous conditions.
The occupation was not being dismembered. It was being made more efficient. It was being consolidated, where Israel would maintain its strategic interests, whether it be hilltops, whether it be water, whether it be different agricultural things that they had interest in, and the Palestinians would have what was left, basically. And if they wanted to call it a state, they could call it a state. If they wanted to print postage stamps, they could print postage stamps. If they wanted to have a national anthem, feel free.
The second myth that the Israeli PR machine was able to spin was that Arafat, having rejected the deal of a lifetime, then incited the Intifada out of spite.
An expert consultant on MSNBC.
The failure of these negotiations, which the United States supported, in which the Israelis made serious offers, that the Palestinians in leadership decided on a strategy of street fighting as a response.
When this latest round of violence broke out, if you look at the editorials that ran in the big American newspapers, they overwhelmingly said that the cause of the violence was Arafat's rejection of the Camp David Accord, and they blamed the Palestinians, and they sided with Israel.
Rabbi Arik Asherman.
This intifada had very little to do with Camp David, because on the ground, parallel to what the leaders were talking about, who had become so many talking heads as far as the average Palestinian was concerned, you had ongoing land expropriation, tree uprootings, road building. Settlements were being expanded at a quicker pace under Barak than they had been under Netanyahu. Unfair water allocation, by which many Palestinians in the summer and fall have approximately 2 hours of running water a week, when next door you can have a settlement with green lawns and a swimming pool. So what are people supposed to think? Rightly or wrongly, this said to people, this is not a peace process. And even if it is, by the time it's concluded, everything I have is going to be gone. It's going to be expropriated. So what's in it for me?
On September 28, 2000, Ariel Sharon, then Israel's defense minister, sparked the Palestinian Intifada with a provocative visit to a site in Jerusalem, holy to both Jews and Muslims. Surrounded by hundreds of riot police, Sharon strode onto the contested sacred site as a demonstration of Israel's control of the area. Sharon was met with protests from Palestinians, who began hurling rocks at police and who then stormed the holy site. Israeli riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at the protesters. The rioting quickly spread to other parts of East Jerusalem and to Ramallah in the West Bank. Dozens, both Israelis and Palestinians, were injured. The Palestinian Intifada had begun.
In 1942 to 1943, the Jews of Warsaw, Poland, found themselves in a situation that had one or two similarities to the Palestinians of West Bank and Gaza today. Here's their story.
First they occupied our country. Then they spread their vicious lies. Evil propaganda filled our ranks with double-dealing spies. They cordoned off a reservation, built a wall all around it, drove us all into this ghetto, and our city'd never be as the Nazis found. First no one believed it, just what horrors lay in store. The sound of boots upon the staircase, of leather gloves upon the door. Some of us they sent to labor, to slave for them to the last breath. Most of us they sent to Auschwitz, 500,000 people sent to a pointless early death. There were those of us who worked with them, a desperate effort to survive. Even when our numbers were so few, maybe 60,000 left alive. People said we had no chances. By then we all knew they were right. It was 1943, and we, the walking dead, made up our minds to fight. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died. We cleansed the ghetto of their agents, dug a maze of tunnels underground. We begged the Allies give us weapons, but empty words was all we found. So we saved each precious bottle, made bombs of rags and gasoline. And in this script of mindless carnage, we waited in the shadows for the final scene. It was the month of April. The SS came marching in, singing songs to praise Der Führer and all his Aryan kin. To see the shock upon their faces, we'd show the world on this day we'd not go like sheep off to the slaughter. With the last blood running through our hearts, we'd make the devils pay. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died. We had taken our positions, each escape route planned. We rained down Molotovs upon them, with each retreat another stand. Yes, we killed the Nazi bastards. They lay dying by the score. We made each scarce bullet count, and as the demons ran, we killed some more. For one full month the battle raged, and the word spread all around that it wasn't over till every building had been leveled to the ground. I am the ghost of the apocalypse, and these few words I have to tell. Let it never be forgotten that for four long weeks we fought, we stood up before we fell. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died.
PR strategy number 7, marginalized voices.
Public relations works not only by controlling the content of media reports, but also by making sure that some voices are never heard. The marginalization of the Israeli peace movement in the American media is an example of how this works.
It's been the point of view of the Israeli peace movement for years that the fundamental cause of the conflict is the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land and the settlement policies. But that view is considered in the United States something that's extremely marginal, and that you rarely see that view put forward in the American media.
Israeli activist Gila Svirsky.
We, in the Women's Peace Camp in Israel, organized a mass vigil of women in black and a mass march through the streets of Jerusalem. 2,000 women strong, both Israelis and Palestinians. Can you picture that dramatic moment? 2,000 women dressed in black marching down the streets of Jerusalem to the walls of the Old City, where we hung banners from the walls of the Old City saying peace in three languages, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And guess what? It didn't get into the media.
That's not the kind of image that the media wants to create, because then all these images of Jews and Arabs working together, of Palestinians wanting peace, would create a kind of dissonance. It would contradict the message that the media has been giving us for years and years. Then how do you explain it? You can't explain it.
One of the many groups working for peace inside the occupied territories that has not received coverage in the United States is the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. The committee's work has attracted a range of Israelis committed to peace, including Israeli soldiers.
Our role is to go there and to rebuild Palestinian homes as a constructive way of resisting occupation. We're going to a Palestinian village and we're standing shoulder to shoulder, hand to hand, with Palestinian people who wish to have peace with Israelis. And in that way, where a lot of Palestinians are seeing that there are other Israelis, not the one who demolishes, but others who are rebuilding, and it keeps a flame of hope for a better future.
In January 2001, 53 Israeli reserve officers in the Israeli Defense Force publicly refused to serve beyond the 1967 borders. They signed a petition stating that they would not serve in the occupied territories in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. Since then, hundreds of Israeli officers and soldiers have joined the movement, Courage to Refuse. For their refusal, they have paid a heavy price, including serving jail time and being labeled traitors.
I'm an Israeli patriot. We are Israeli patriots. I served more than 25 years in the Israeli army as a major in the IDF. All of us were volunteering to do their army service in dangerous places, and we earned the right to say that the occupation doesn't serve the security of Israel. And we're doing it from our stand as a specialist for military job. We're the military. We know what provides security. And we paid with our time and energy. Some of us paid with their blood in order to keep Israel safe. And if from our point of view, as patriots, as Zionists, as officers in the Israeli army, we're saying that the occupation has nothing to do with security, we have the right to say it.
There are many American Jews who also believe it is their right to speak out against the occupation. Included among them are Jewish American rabbis. For their refusal to keep silent, they too have suffered threats and intimidation.
One part of that intimidation has been to say that any Jew who raises criticisms about a current Israeli policy is a self-hating Jew. But on the contrary, my criticisms and Tikkun magazine's criticisms of Israeli policy flow directly from our commitment to Judaism and our love for the Jewish tradition and our insistence that it be taken seriously, not just as a bunch of empty words, but as a set of principles that we really take seriously and believe in.
The Israeli public relations machine knows that if the views and voices of Jews who disagree with its policies were to become public, it would be impossible to maintain the lie that any criticism of Israel is by definition anti-Semitic. In fact, the accusation of anti-Semitism has been Israel's most effective strategy in silencing dissent, and American journalists in particular have been targets of this tactic.
Any environment in which a journalist or any person steps forward and starts making serious criticism of Israel, of America's relationship with Israel, the unconditional support for Israel, the failure of any serious pressure to be put upon Israel by the United States to prevent the building of further settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab land, any suggestion that the war between the Israelis and the Palestinians is a colonial war will be met by a deafening chorus of accusations, slanderous and lying though they are, that the person who brings up that subject is in some form an anti-Semite or a racist. And this remains the constant weapon that is used.
The fact that anti-Semitism is alive and well in the world today makes it all the more important to differentiate between real anti-Semitism that needs to be condemned and opposed in its own right, and its misuse as a PR strategy. Trying to scare people into silence by conflating any criticism of Israeli policies with anti-Semitism, in fact, detracts from the very real threat that anti-Semitism does pose.
Because there are anti-Semites in the world, there are racists, and if this continued campaign of abuse against decent people, trying to shut them up by falsely accusing them of anti-Semitism continues, the word anti-Semitism will begin to become respectable. And that is a great danger. And then the really bad guys, and they're around, there are people who want to burn synagogues, just like there are people who want to burn mosques, they'll start coming into their own.
Is peace possible?
Through its unconditional support for Israel, the American government has become one of the biggest obstacles to achieving peace. Consequently, the struggle for peace and justice in the Middle East will have to be waged here in the United States.
Because the United States has primary responsibility for this. There's nothing either anti-Semitic or being a self-hating Jew and condemning U.S. policies which underlie massive atrocities. And have been blocking a peaceful settlement. I've led the world pretty close to war several times, nuclear war. These are things that we ought to be concerned about. I mean, what Israel does, it's for them to worry about. What we do is for us to worry about.
Americans need to wake up and find out what's happening in their name throughout the world. They have a responsibility. If they pretend to live in a democratic society, which is being eroded, in terms of how democratic it is, to find out what your government is supporting, what it's doing overseas in your name with your tax dollars.
I mean, people here do not want to send helicopters to attack civilians. You know, if people know what's going on in the occupied territories, they're not going to want to support it. I mean, any more than they support other atrocities that we're responsible for. So you keep it quiet. Describe it as a defense against terrorism, not as a brutal military occupation which is evoking resistance. If U.S. policy shifts, the coverage will shift.
The occupation doesn't serve security, and if the American public opinion will come to understand this very truth that we believe in, we hope that the administration, that the president will do whatever he can in order to help to facilitate a peace talks which will bring end to the occupation on one hand, safety and security to Israel on the other hand, and decent life for the Palestinians, as he suggested in his speech. He said it very beautifully, but he's doing nothing about it.
The only way that Israel will have peace and security is by making peace with our neighbors. The only way that we will have a safe Israel is by making a just peace with the Palestinians.
Their struggle in many ways is a just struggle. What are they struggling? They're struggling for a state. We in Israel have a state. The American people have a state. Why shouldn't the Palestinian people have a state?
This program comes to you from station WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed are mine alone. See you next week.